their fog machine.
Oh, okay.
All right. I hit the button one time and all the fog started coming out.
Yeah. That'd be funny.
Yeah, that was that pretty funny. But it was funny. That's no big deal. I mean, yeah. All right. So I'm going to do a very, very brief little side trip looking at archaeology and the book of Genesis. Now, you're not going to find actual archaeological remains that would reflect the story of the Bible until the time of the kings. Because before that time, God's people were living in a tent. I mean, what would you find from Abraham? In nothing. There's nothing to find. So we don't have archaeological proof of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But what we do have is clear evidence that the stories in Genesis reflect the situation in Mesopotamia in the period around 1800 to 2000 BC. A lot of,
So were all the altars and things that they built, were they real loose and easily decomposed, break
well,
down, whatever?
Abraham built very, very simple altars, clearly.
Right, so that's
so we're not going to find those. And even if we did, how would we know? All right, but see, a lot of people say the book of Genesis is a bunch of fables. There was no such person as Abraham. All this was written like 800 B.C., and this has nothing to do with what actually happened. But the fact is, the archaeological details show us that opinion is certainly not true. That the book of Genesis reflects Mesopotamia in a period roughly 2000 B.C. I just want to show you some evidence for that. First of all, there's the city of Ur, which was described in Genesis as this very, very wealthy city out of which Abraham came. Ur was actually abandoned something around 1500 B.C. And at the time when these skeptics say the Old Testament was written, Ur hadn't existed for hundreds and hundreds of years, and surely the very name Ur didn't even exist as a historical memory. Also, the Bible says that Abraham went from Ur to Haran. And you get the sense that Haran is kind of like in the frontier of Mesopotamia, and it is an actual city. We have the ruins of Haran. Haran was abandoned around 1800 B.C., and never occupied again as a city named Haran. And so if the story of Genesis was made up, how do you explain the fact that it mentions this city that, when the skeptics say Genesis was written, hadn't existed for 1,000 years? Seems a bit of a stretch. And then there's the Ebla tablets. That's kind of interesting. The Ebla tablets, there's 17,000 clay tablets found in Ebla. Ebla is the area of northwest Mesopotamia, where Paddan Aram is, where Haran is, where Abraham's family lived. And some of the names mentioned in the Ebla tablets include Nahor, Terug, Abram, Sarai. These were actual names of actual Aramaean people living actually around 1800 to 2000 B.C. All right, and so if somebody's making up a story 1,000 years later, they would have had to sort of dig up names that nobody had been using for 1,000 years. Let's say that somebody gave you a letter. This letter is from back in the Civil War, you're reading it, and it refers to people like, I don't know. What's the name that they use now that never was used before?
That they didn't.
Yeah, we need a young person to answer this question. Sorry, Killian.
Shut down.
I don't know. Brittany or Jamal or Skyler. You know, if you're reading something from supposedly from 1864, Brittany, Skyler, and Jamal, you're like, yeah, give me a break. All right. So the point is, clearly, the book of Genesis represents material that came from Mesopotamia around 1800 to 2000 B.C. There's another interesting thing. We're going to read in Genesis 31. We won't get there today. We'll get there next Saturday. It's the story about Laban, who chased down Jacob and Rebekah. I'm sorry, Jacob and Rachel. And not to get Rachel back, but to get the teraphim back, the household gods. Like, what's up with that? And why did Rachel take the household gods? Well, if you look in the Nuzi tablets, there's a law that says, basically, the father can give the inheritance to a son-in-law, and the way they do that is by giving them, in a ceremony, the household gods, the teraphim. And it says, whoever holds the teraphim gets the inheritance. Ah, okay. And if someone is making up a story, what a strange story. What a really strange story. He was more interested in getting the household gods back than his sheep and goats and all his possessions and his daughters. But now we know because we can read the Nuzi tablets. That's news, not Nuzi, N-E-W-S-Y. Nuzi, N-U-Z-I, which is a city in northwest Mesopotamia. And then there's the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. That's an interesting one. If you go there, I was in that area 3 years ago, and it is desolate. It's been essentially uninhabited for, forever. Well, not quite forever, because it turns out they decided to do some archaeological digs there, despite the fact that anybody would say, you're crazy. Clearly, there were never any cities here. Now, if you read in Genesis 14, there were five significant-sized cities around the Dead Sea, right? Well, guess how many cities they discovered? Five. And it turns out, in the period between 2500 and 2000 BC, it was a period when it was relatively... Now, it was not a wet area. It's not like jungle. It was quite dry, but there were these wadis, which are these brooks, which apparently flowed all year long, and there was extensive irrigation there. In fact, the most extensive irrigation probably in the entire area of the Promised Land was right there around the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea was twice the size it is now. You can get the idea. Let me see. Oh, this thing. Well, need a new battery, so I'll just point. All right, just imagine that up there is the current Dead Sea. It was quite a bit larger, five cities. The largest of them is Bab ed Dra.
There it goes. There it goes.
James. Thank you, James. It's green, right? Okay. All right, there's Bab ed Dra, which is the biblical Sodom. All right. And when they did excavations there, they found up to 7 feet thick of ruins filled with ashes. In fact, all five cities were destroyed somewhere around 2000 to 2100 BC by fire and never, ever occupied again. That's interesting. In fact, outside of Bab ed Dra, there are the ruins of Bab ed Dra. There was a graveyard, and there were these wooden structures, and the wooden structures had been burned, not from the bottom to the top, which is what happens when you burn something down. They were burned from the top to the bottom. That's interesting. And then there are the Hittites. You know, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, and all those otherites. People said the Hittites were a mere fantasy. This is just a bunch of fables. They're Hittites. And in fact, you get the sense the Hittites might have been the most powerful of these people other than the Egyptians. But until the late 1800s, archaeologists were unanimous. There was no such thing as Hittites. And then Hugo Winkler in 1906 discovered the city of Hattusha, which is a very large city, the capital of the Hittite Empire. And there were over 50 cities in the Hittite Empire. There is the extent of the Hittite Empire in the 1400s BC. It was the chief rival to both Syria and Egypt. And its land extended down to the northern part of the Promised Land. Hattusha, my thing's not working. It's kind of, it's that white dot as opposed to the other dots there, Hattusha. And here are the city gates of this people that didn't even exist. And there are universities where you could even get a major in the Hittite language. So I don't know. I'm thinking, I'm trusting the Old Testament to be reliable history. Although I will have to say there's no physical proof of the person Abraham or Isaac. Neither would you expect it. Yes? No, I mean, salt dissolves, by the way. And we certainly would not expect to have statues of Abraham, Isaac, or any of these people. They are relatively minor figures, all right, on the world stage at that time. During his lifetime, Abraham owned a few acres. Well, what else did he own? Sheep,
cattle.
All right, so... You would certainly not expect to find any archaeological evidence confirming it. Looking for it is a waste of time. But the fact is, the archaeological evidence does agree with the picture. In fact, the clear evidence is the book of Genesis, which may have been compiled later. In fact, it was compiled later. We know that. It goes back to legitimate material that came from the time in question. Now, Genesis 22, that's my favorite chapter in Genesis. I don't go with that. You're wasting your time. You're wasting your time. All right. Now there are, by the way, there are literally pillars of salt in that area. And in fact, what's that lake east of Yosemite? They got these interesting. Yeah, right. Those things they really exist. And you know, it could be that's what actually happened. She fell. I don't know. But let's not waste too much time speculating about that. All right. Genesis 22, sometime later, God tested Abraham. Sounds like Job, doesn't it? God tested Abraham. He said to him, Abraham. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever heard God's voice coming out of the sky. But you know what? Maybe it's better off that you don't hear that, you know. Noah! Abraham! It's like... Yeah. God said, take your son, your only son who you love. Now, again, remember how Ishmael and Hagar and Isaac and Sarah were a story about salvation and about us being chosen? And this also is a story which is fulfilled in great detail in the life of Jesus. So as we read this story, imagine who these characters are. Take your son, your only son whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountaintop. I will show you. Early the next morning, Abraham got up, loaded his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. When he cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. On the third day, Abraham looked up. He saw the place in the distance. He said to his servants, stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you. Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering, and he placed it on his son Isaac. He himself carried the fire and the knife, and the two of them went on together. Isaac spoke up and said to his father Abraham, Father, yes, my son, Abraham replied. The fire and the wood are here, Isaac said, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? Abraham said enigmatically, God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And the two of them went on together. When they reached the place God had told him about, Abraham built an altar. There he arranged the wood, he bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And he reached out his hand. He took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord said, called out to him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham. Now that time Abraham was glad to hear the voice of the angel. This is an amazing story. In this story, who is Abraham? God. Who's Isaac? Jesus. Take your son, your only son whom you love. Sacrifice him on Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah is the same mountain that Jerusalem is built on. God asked Abraham to sacrifice his one and only son on the same mountain that God offered his one and only son as a sacrifice. You know, I'm tempted to figure, you know, that's his job to give up his son. I mean, come on. I mean, he's God. It's kind of, you know, how did Abraham feel about sacrificing his one and only son? The way Chrysostom, the Greek church father, put it, the things of God seem to fight against the things of God. The faith fought with faith, and the commandment fought with the promise. Yet in faith, Abraham obeyed the command. The promise was, through Isaac, all nations will be blessed. And the command was, kill Isaac. Sometimes God's commands seem to go counter to what we think makes sense. You know what we need to do? We need to do what Abraham did. Early the next day, he circumcised Isaac on the eighth day. Early the next day, he went out and he left. And, you know, when he went to Moriah, his son was as good as dead. As far as he was concerned, his son was good as dead. You know, in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 4, where Paul says that the Messiah must die according to the Scriptures, I could find that prophecy, you know, Psalm 22, Isaiah 53. But then it says that the Messiah should be raised from the dead on the third day according to the Scriptures. It took me a long time to find that prophecy. This is that prophecy. In fact, in Hebrews 11, 19, it says, figuratively, Abraham received his son back from the dead when? On the third day. So this is a prophecy. Not only that God would die as a sacrifice, but that he would come back from the dead on the third day. So that's sort of cool. I find that to be interesting. God was willing to give up his one and only son who he loved. The cool thing is this actually happened, and Abraham has no idea. Abraham has no concept of the fact that he's telling us about God giving up his one and only son. He has no idea. All he knows is God says it and he obeyed. Now, would you have done that? Would you have gone to that mountain? I'm not going to make any claim like that. No way.
Ben is relieved.
Yeah. So they show up at the mountain. And notice this. He places the wood on Isaac. Isaac carried the wood up the mountain that was going to be used for a sacrifice. Just like Jesus carried the wood, literally, up the same mountain that was going to be used for a sacrifice. But who carried the knife?
Abraham.
See the symbolism. Abraham. God offered his son. So if you're going to blame somebody, blame God. Abraham carried the knife. Yeah. All right, it says it right there in Hebrews 11. See, he didn't argue with God. What he did was he obeyed God, but he did reason. And his reasoning was, I don't know. God will raise him from the dead. You can see that. It's in Hebrews 11, 19. I guess he figured. I mean, the reasoning here is very, very faithful reasoning. You know, we're worried about trusting God with our finances or our job or our situation. And basically, God was calling him to do a heinous act, essentially. And he reasoned, God will raise him from the dead. And figuratively, the Hebrew writer says, that's exactly what happened. Yes. To say the least. Yeah. This is a fantastic victory. This is an amazing victory. Dan?
This is the man that scoffed at the idea that he'd have a son
right
by Sarah, and now he's willing to.
And by the way, we're going to see.
Back.
similar Jacob. Jacob had a way worse start than Abraham. But even Jacob became a man of great faith. Yeah.
A lot of it goes back to the fact that God, that Abraham believed that God could raise the dead. That was where his faith connected.
Yeah.
The promise of God was that God could raise from the dead with a dead body.
Right.
That's how he reasoned that God would raise up.
Right, and this is a great explanation, but I just want our jaws to drop at this thing. I mean, this is crazy stuff. The faith that Abraham... No wonder God chose Abraham. No wonder he was truly a man of great faith. But, you know, now we're going up the mountain, and at some point, Isaac's like, wow... This is getting interesting here. Dad, you know, where's the lamb? And Abraham says, God will provide. Now, when God, how do you think Abraham felt about saying that to his son, knowing what he was about to do to his son? You know? And they get up there, and it's you know, Abraham bound Isaac. You know... Isaac's there, and Abraham's building the thing, and Isaac's like, this is really fishy. And then he says, is it okay if I tie you up? Do you think Isaac at some point figured out what's going on here? I think he did.
This is fishy. You think?
I think he figured it out. To me, it reminds me of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane saying, you know, essentially, not my will, but your will be done. Isaac trusted Abraham. You know, which is more amazing? That Isaac trusted Abraham. But that's the kind of faith, because in this story, although Isaac is Jesus, Isaac is also us. Yeah. Right? As opposed to Ishmael. Question or comment?
So, if that's the story compared to Jesus and God, so why... When Jesus died on the cross and we put him on the cross, why was everybody so prominent to say crucify him? They had not read the story and they had not seen the story, or they didn't know about the story. Why couldn't they compare it then?
Well, I mean, how about today? How about almost everybody you know who says they're religious and they totally aren't a Christian at all? How about them?
Good point.
Sure. Of course, a lot of the Jews became Christians. I've got to remember that. But yeah, I mean, most people refuse to come to God. Most people choose not to believe, right? In Romans chapter 1, it says they willfully ignore the evidence, but the evidence is right in front of them. But then again, you've read this story before in Genesis 22. You didn't get this story the first time you read it, right? Okay, so it to the eyes of faith, the eyes of faith can see it. The eyes of not faith may not even see it, especially this one, which is, it's not immediately obvious. But once you get it, it's very, very obvious, I would say. So if we're going to follow Abraham, we have to follow Abraham out of Haran, which is where you leave everything behind. But if you're a Christian, you already did that. But you also have to follow Abraham to Mount Moriah, which where your faith is put on the line there. Yeah. Yeah, if I'm right. Now, archaeologists will not have 100% agreement that Mount Moriah is the city that Jerusalem is built on. It's the most common understanding of that. All right, you could even measure out the three-day travel and figure out where he was and whether that makes sense. And it does make sense. But, you know, I'm the way I'm giving you the story, I'm acting as if this is a slam dunk, and archaeologists would not agree it's a slam dunk, but I would say, given the Bible, it is a slam dunk. All right, it's pretty obvious, actually. All right, and the evidence agrees with that, but it's not proved, and don't act as if it is, because it's not proved. There's a lot of parallels here also between Israel and Egypt, because again, the firstborn son were doomed to die, right? And God provided a lamb and saved the firstborn sons. So there's parallels here to the Jews. if the Jews would have noticed anything about this story, they would have made a parallel to the Passover, actually, rather than to Jesus, who they didn't, a lot of them didn't recognize. But I really like verse 14 here. I'll start in verse 13. Abraham looked up, and there in the thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. And I want you to catch the emotion here. He went over, he took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the place, "The Lord will provide." And to this day it is said, on the mountain of the Lord it'll be provided. That's a great story. God will provide if we put faith in him. So the question is, do you believe that? Will you sacrifice even the thing that God gave you, even the blessing that God gave you, your wife, your son, your daughter, your career, whatever? Are you willing to lay that on the altar if God calls you to do that? And will you see God's providence even when it appears to not be providence at all? Now, because of that, God gives Abraham, again, it's been a theme. God gives the promise, but God gives him a promise one more time. All right? So he says here, because of his faith, he renews the covenant. Look at this in verse 16. Look at this, the assurance. The angel of the Lord called to Abraham from heaven a second time and said, "I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you. I'll make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies. And through your offspring, all nations and earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me." God promises. He says, "I swear." Yeah.
There's a parallel here. The way that Abraham obeyed God, God would respond to that.
Yes.
The same way.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that Abraham was allowed to spare his son, but God would not spare his son.
Right.
It's because he didn't. Oh, wow. It's sort of like there's a connection here.
Right. Because of Abraham's faith, God did not spare his one and only son. It's a great point. And this statement, this is our fifth statement of these, repeat of these promises in different form, but this is the most emphatic of them all. God says, "I swear." Like I said, it's like the George Burns movie, you know, So Help Me Me. I swear. And if you want to have some assurance of God's promises, go to Hebrews chapter 6. Let's go there. God essentially is repeating the same promise he gave to Abraham. He's repeating it to us through the Hebrew writer. If you read Hebrews 6, you could feel a little bit like, wow, I'm not sure if I'm going to make it. Wow, it's good. Man, if you turn back, you know, no coming back and all that kind of stuff. But I'm thankful for chapter 6, verse 13. All right, Hebrews 6. All right, verse 13 says, "When God made his promise to Abraham, since there was no one greater for him to swear by, he swore by himself, saying, 'I will surely bless you. And I'll give you many descendants.' So after waiting patiently, Abraham received what was promised." And he's saying to us, we need to wait patiently for God to fulfill his promise. Verse 18 and 19 says, "God did this so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled to take hold of the hope set before us may be greatly encouraged. We have this hope as an anchor for the soul, firm and secure. It enters the inner sanctuary behind the curtain." So this is our promise. It says it's like an anchor in the Holy of Holies. We have great assurance. Okay? So Genesis 22 is like a triumphant climax to the story of Abraham. I appreciate Abby's comment about that. Anyway, from it, he emerges with his promised son intact and with the blessing affirmed. And from now on, whenever God wants to give us assurance, he refers back to this event. God refers back many, many times Deuteronomy 1:8, many, many times, God says, look, I swore to Abraham. That, you know, I swore to Abraham. That should be good enough. God reminds you, look, I swore to Abraham. Great. Now, I'm going to start, I only have like, what, 10 minutes, 15, 12 minutes left, something like that. But I'm going to actually get through about three or four chapters during that time. Genesis 23, Abraham buys a field. He buys a cave and a field in Machpelah. Up to this point, how much of the promised land has God inherited? Exactly zero. So he buys a field. How big is this field? I don't know. Not super big. A field with a cave in it. Because he knows that he will live forever in the promised land. Right? Just like we. Because basically, he's been walking around in a place that's merely a picture of his inheritance. He doesn't receive it. And again, we're back in Hebrews again. Hebrews 11:13. We're going to be challenged that we ought to probably have faith here. Hebrews 11:13. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting they were foreigners and strangers. And that describes Abraham perfectly. And this Hittite guy says, sure, I'll give you the land. No, 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 don't give it to me. I want to buy it. I want to buy it. He buys that land. And eventually he and Sarah and Isaac and Rebecca and Jacob, Rachel and Leah were all buried in that cave. And it's kind of a symbol that they're going to be in the promised land in heaven for eternity. So what about you? Where do you put your treasures? Are you like Abraham, seeing that we have very little treasure here, that our promise lies in the future, that our hope is in heaven? Where is your citizenship? See, I told you, we're going to get through these chapters fast. We're in chapter 24 now. Isaac and Rebekah. Now, this is an awesome story, worth an hour, but I'm going to spend 5 minutes, okay? Because we really need to talk about Jacob and Joseph. We only have 1 week to talk about Jacob and Joseph. That's terrible. But again, Abraham trusts God. First of all, God said, through your children, you know, this promise will be reckoned. And he's like, all right, great. So Isaac, great. So, but I can't send him back to the world. Like any Christian parent, he realizes that he's got to set up his son, hopefully to marry within the church, right? So he sends his servant off. There's the thing about Abraham's marriage to Keturah and his death, by the way. There's the thing in chapter 25 about the descendants of Ishmael. But anyway, let's read verse 6 through 8 of chapter 24. Genesis chapter 24, verse 6 through 8. Genesis 24, verses 6 through 8. All right, make sure you do not take my son back there. Basically, he's doing what you parents are trying to do, right? Trying to keep him in the kingdom. You know, you're trying to protect them, to protect them from worldly influences. So he says, I'm not going to send him over there. I'm going to send my servant over there to bring a wife back. And I don't know if I'm stretching the symbolism here, so I'll let you think about that and apply it as you will. All right. But anyway, make sure that you do not take my son back there. Abraham said, the Lord, the God of heaven, who brought me out of my father's household and my native land, who spoke to me and promised me an oath, saying, to your offspring I will give this land. He will send his angel before you. As you send your daughter off to college, he will send his angel before you. As they go off and take a job and they kind of head out into the world. You know, and all of us who have teenage kids, we're kind of heading that way, right? Yeah. Paul's done that. He sent his kids off, you know. But Abraham believed that God's angel would go before him to take care of him and bring a wife. And then there's the sort of cool story in verses 12 through 14. That's kind of a fun story. So the servant goes off, and he's been given this charge, and so he prays. So he's coming up to Paddan Aram, to the city there. I think the city's called Nahor, where the relatives live. And his charge was to find somebody from that area. It wasn't even very specific. All right, and so he's praying that God totally blesses the situation. He says, Lord God of my master Abraham, make me successful today. Show kindness to my master Abraham. See, I'm standing beside the spring, and the daughters of the townspeople are coming out to draw water. May it be that when I say to a young woman, please let me let down your jar that I may have a drink, and she says, drink and I'll water your camels too. Let her be the one you have chosen for your servant Isaac. By this I will know that you have shown kindness to my master. Before he had finished praying, Rebekah came out in her jar on her shoulders. You know the story. Not only did she offered to give him a sip, she offered to give him a ladle. She said, hey, look, why don't I water your camels for you? How much do you think camels drink? I think they drink a lot. And this woman, Rebekah, was a pretty amazing woman. She was a power woman, actually. In fact, ultimately, she overpowered Isaac. I don't know how good that was. But, you know.
It was a win.
Isaac had some weaknesses there. Anyway, long story short, the servant brings back this bright, energetic, beautiful, and very hospitable Rachel. All right? And when she came back, Rebecca. And when she comes back, Isaac is very fired up. He takes one look, like, ah, good job there. He's really seeing the spiritual aspects, right? Well, we do learn something about Laban here. Laban seems to be more concerned with money. He's like, I don't know. And then, oh, I see the camels. Camels were quite rare back then, believe it or not. And the gold ring and the gold nose ring. And yeah, okay, sure. Are you going to give me, you know, a few $100,000? Sure, you can have my daughter. And Laban doesn't come across very well here. He's kind of a worldly guy. All right, but, you know, there you go. So Abraham dies after having other children by Keturah. And we see Ishmael has many, many descendants who become the parents of the tribes of the Arabs. All right, so now we're entering our next section. This is the period about Isaac. Now, the period about Isaac is not about Isaac. The story from chapter 25 through 28, on paper, it's about Isaac, but it's really not about Isaac. It's about Jacob. Isaac is a relatively minor character in Genesis compared to Jacob. And we get the sense that Isaac was, he's a good guy. I mean, he put faith in God. There's that whole chapter 26 with Abimelech, and he does the right thing. Isaac is a good guy. He was faithful to God. But he was had a somewhat weak character. And it seems like perhaps he didn't take the role of a patriarch of his household quite as seriously as he should have. So on the surface, Genesis 25 through 28 is about Isaac, but really it's about Jacob and Esau. And what it's really about is unmerited favor. So I have to end here. I'm going to read one little thing, and then I'm going to end. But as we start talking about Jacob and Esau, this is about God's unmerited favor. God chooses us not because we're awesome. He chooses us because he loves us. And because he promised, and because of the faith of Abraham. If it were not for the faith of Abraham, none of this would have happened. All right, so let's just read this little section here, kind of as a way to introduce ourselves to Jacob and Esau. All right, let me see here. Genesis 25, verse 21. By the way, Rebekah was barren for 20 years. There's that. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was childless. The Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebekah became pregnant. The babies jostled each other within her. By the way, the word jostled is actually the word for smashed or crushed. So the translators soften that a little bit. And Rebecca is having a really tough pregnancy here. She's, man, some of the ladies are like, yeah, but all right, as bad as it was, I have a feeling, I don't want to say anything. For me, to a guy to say anything is just a bad idea probably anyway. But I have a feeling Rebecca, let's just say she had a really tough pregnancy, okay? These guys are wrestling and fighting and pushing each other inside of her very womb. And she said, man, why'd you make me pregnant? Be careful what you pray for, right? The Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebecca became pregnant. The babies jostled. Why is this happening to me? She went out to inquire the Lord. The Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. The older is Esau, also known as Edom. Edom, which means red, because of his red hair. And Esau meaning hairy, because Esau was hairy. All right? He had a lot of hair. And as he's coming out of the womb, Jacob's hand's grabbing his foot, because Jacob is going to steal the blessing. But really, this is God's providence. Because God wants us to know that the Gentiles will be Christians as well. And the Jews will forfeit that covenant if they don't come into God's people. And so we're going to see God's providence. We're going to read Romans 9, 10 through 13, where it says, Jacob I loved, Esau I hated. We think, what's that mean? We're going to learn it means that God chose Jacob. Why? Because he did. Because of his promise. We're not saved because we're awesome. And thank you for reminding us that Abraham did not have to sacrifice his son, but God did. So anyway, next Saturday we're going to finish up. We're going to do the story of Jacob and Esau and Joseph. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Hopefully we have light next week. Esau sells his birthright.
So next week's the last one?
Yep. And we can do it pretty quickly because we're going to skip through these stories that are so familiar. Yeah.
John, some of these details, you know, there's some very major details of things that are being said. And, you know, why would they have even remembered that the kid's hand was holding on to the heel as he was coming out? I mean,
I'm sure that, see, when, I'm sure when people told the story of Jacob and Esau and their... That this story, it kind of summed the whole thing up. So it's probably a very rememberable thing.
Does it have a meaning? Why?
That's why he was called Jacob.
The word Jacob means grasp the heel.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what it means. Yeah. Now, God changed his name to Israel. God changed him. You know, God changes his name because God changed Jacob. God made Jacob from a selfish, scheming liar to a man of great faith. It's an awesome story.
He was a weasel.
Was.
Yeah.
You're pretty tough on people, Rudy. You got to be a little bit nicer.
But it wasn't God's promise. I mean, he says it when she's pregnant. You know that.
Right. Right, and that's what it says in Romans 12, Romans 9, rather.
So, I mean, I don't see it as him being a weasel. I see it as God using his talent.
Right.
Some people like that, you know, like Sam is literally...
It's God's predestination.
He's there, like...
He was shrewd, I guess we can say shrewd.
He's like, uses his, whatever God gave him.
Right.
He was into the things of God.
Yeah, Romans 9 explains it pretty well. But before either of them had done anything, God chose him. So it wasn't about how awesome he was. But the fact that he wasn't so awesome tells us something as well.
Right.
But the main thing is that God chose him. That's the main point, at least in Romans.
Esau was like the example of a manly man.
Well, it's not like just like choosing us, but we're not, you know, like you said, awesome.
Right.
Like, God, all kinds of messed up stuff going on.
Exactly.